Tiger Woods is in a bit of trouble, hunkered down in the cold and wind in what appears to be a long, tough battle against Nick O'Hearn.
Thank you, and good night, Tiger.
What a way to do it. 3-1.
I've been here before, I've played here before, and beat him before.
Tiger Woods and Nick O'Hearn are headed to sudden death.
Nick O'Hearn has this to win.
Yes! Oh! Nick O'Hearn once again is a Tiger slayer.
He looks like he's aiming right at it.
Looks good. Oh, this is great.
It's got it. Oh, oh, what a shot!
Hello and welcome to episode one of Tour Mentality Golf Fans. It's a podcast that's effectively Nick O'Hearn's crackerjack book of the same name come to life in audio form. I'm Matt Cleary. I'm a sports writer from Sydney and the host of the show, and you can Google me if you're of a mind. But the star of the piece, of course, is the great Nick O'Hearn, who's a year or two back from Isleworth in Florida after a flat-out glittering 20-odd-year career on the European and US PGA Tours, in which he reached bloody number 16 in the world, played on two President's Cup teams, and, of course, twice beat Tiger Woods in match play. And I'm sure we'll hear more of these things in due course. Hello, Nick. How you going, mate? You'd pretty much introduce yourself these days, wouldn't you? Hello, I'm Nick O'Hearn, twice Slayer of the Tiger.
Yeah, probably not a good idea, mate, but depending on who I'm talking to, that's for sure. So, no, great to get this show going. Should be a bit of fun, mate.
Yeah, brilliant, mate. Yeah, we've been talking about it for a while, haven't we, about getting it up. Let's hope we can have a bit of fun and help out people and get people to enjoy their golf, which is obviously the major aim of the game. All right, for those who don't know, these days our Nick's a resident somewhere on Melbourne's Sandbelt where he plays golf, runs clinics, hosts tours and mentors promising young players and passes on lessons from a pro golf career that spanned, over 20 years. And in this podcast, he'll give us all the benefit of what made him a one-time battling single-digit handicapper from West Australia who couldn't make the Mount Lawley pennant team into a President's Cup player, a winner of the Aussie PGA, and as we might have mentioned, and may mention again, twice Slayer of the Tiger in match play golf. That's where people would be well served by getting hold of Nick's book, which is one of, if not the only ones, about mental game by a tour player. And look, hopefully, again, this podcast will kick some goals there too. We aren't going to read the book verbatim. We'll talk of real-world examples of our man under pressure, getting to know himself and his golf game and all those light bulb moments in his golf career that he was able to remember and use in a golf career that turned out to be long and prosperous. So, Nick, how's that intro, mate? You happy with that? What are you up to these days? You've come back to Aussie, written a book and sort of, I don't know, not reinvented yourself as a mentor and life coach of sorts, but you sort of become a bit of a go-to man for the mental side of the game, which, as I said, I think is underrepresented.
Yeah, that was quite an intro, by the way.
I know, I was gibbering away.
Yeah, you're right. Great to be back in Australia. I've been in the US, I guess, the past 12 years, living over there in Orlando, Florida, playing the PGA Tour, and then about 4 or 5 years ago, actually retired from full-time play, more so just because I got to the point where I was out on playing tournaments and in hotel rooms thinking, I don't want to be here. I'd rather be at home with the kids and watching them grow up. So that's kind of one of the main reasons I got out of playing the game full time. And then the book came about, as you mentioned, a few years ago. It was never really my plan to write a book. I mean, we'll probably talk about how that process happened later on.
Yep.
But from that, it led me into then helping other up-and-coming players, elite amateurs, some young pros. Basically, funnily enough, now that I'm back in Australia, I'm helping all levels of golfer, which is a load of fun. And I started out in this game as a teaching pro when I first turned pro because I wasn't good enough to play. So in a way, I've kind of come back full circle to not being so much a teaching pro, more a mentor and helping guys with the parts of the game that aren't, as you referenced, not necessarily taught very much.
Yeah.
And from a player's perspective, more so than a sports psychologist. So, I can sort of, I know exactly what people are going through when they're, shaking hands on the first tee and they can't really tee the ball up or if they've got a 3-foot putt to win a match. I've been there, done that. So, so it's good to relay those experiences and really just help golfers in general because that's what I love doing these days.
Mate, a really nice tidbit I picked up from your book, and you know, when I'm playing well, it's almost like I forget everything but this tidbit, which is effectively just, I have just hit the ball, you have, you know, what do I have to do now? And it's a common theme in your book, and it's there in the preface of your book when you're beating Tiger Woods, and you go back to your mantra pre-shot, which is, what do I have to do right now? And the answer seems to be in the title of chapter one of Tour Mentality, which is, stay in the present, commit to the process. What's that about?
Yeah, it's kind of, that's golf in a nutshell, basically, because when you're hitting a ball, I mean, it's all about focusing what you have to do right there and then, whereas I find most golfers, when they're over the ball, they're worried about not hitting it in the trees or in the water or what they're going to have for dinner that night or is, you know, have I got some homework to do, whatever, depends on what sort of a golfer you are. So what I found early on is the way for me to get my mind back to that moment was asking myself that exact question before I hit a golf shot or when I walk up to the ball, I go, okay, what do I have to do right now? And that actual question brings my mind back to the present moment, which is where I really want to be. And then from there, you know, it's all about committing to a process that you've built into your game. For me, it was a pre-shot routine and that varied depending on whether it was a full shot, bunker shot, chip shot, putting, whatever. But you just have to be in that moment to actually execute at that time. So asking yourself that question, you can never go too far wrong with it.
So how did you apply that mental process when you beat our Tiger in that match play?
Yeah, it was certainly on my mind all day. You know, the first time I played Tiger was in 2005 at the World Match Play. We were in La Costa in Carlsbad, Southern California. And the interesting part about it was my caddy and I had come up with a theory. We said, right, how are we going to beat this guy? I mean, he's just number one in the world, one of the best players to ever play the game. How are we going to beat him? And thinking about it, history shows that he's only ever won majors and big, well, but actually majors in general, when he's been leading or tied for the lead. He's never won coming from behind up until this year when he won the Masters, funnily enough, when he was a few shots back going into the final round. But at the time I played him, he'd never won coming from behind. So I thought, okay, we've got to get a lead early and we've got to just keep that momentum going. And on the first hole, he tees off and it was like a cannon going off. I mean, he just absolutely launched this thing. And I'd seen him on the range, but I'd never played with him on the course. And I looked over my caddy and he's kind of got his mouth wide open going, holy crap, look at that thing. You know? And I must have been doing the same thing because he actually gave me a nudge and he said, mate, they just called your name, you're up. So, yeah, I was pretty much in shock and awe. So it was in those sorts of moments where you got to go, okay, what do I have to do right now? How do I play this game? And throughout that entire match, I kept asking myself that question before I hit every shot. And funnily enough, on the first green, I ended up having an 8-foot putt to halve the hole and standing behind me while I was lining the putt up. My caddy says to me, mate, this is for the match right here. Just going on our getting behind to him theory because I didn't want to go one down. And I knocked that in dead center, birdied the next two holes, had a 2-up lead from, and I never looked back. But, you know, throughout that day, yeah, every time I stood over a ball or got to the ball, more importantly, was like, yeah, what do I have to do right now? How do I hit this golf shot and go from there? And I think for whether you're playing the club comp or whether you're playing Australian Open or, you know, as it turned out, a World Match Play, it applies to any golf shot that you hit.
All right. Mate, an angle of this podcast will be myself. I'm a pretty generic club amateur, sort of 9-marker, you know, typical sort of golf nut, mad for it, play it, watch it, read about it and all that sort of stuff. And I'll be sort of asking questions for all us choppers and golf nuts and such. And then down the track, we'll have an Ask Nick sort of section and do our best to cover off stuff that's not in the book and anyone can ask a question and go from there. But look, my question, Nick, is that, look, everyone chokes, if you like, from tour pros to amateurs. Everyone feels pressure and deals with it how they do. You know, for club golfers, it's all relative. You know, the monthly medals are a big thing. And, mate, let's say I've got, as they say, a round going on. I could be coming down 15, 16, a couple of shots up and right in the monthly medal. And I think about winning, you know, and which is poison. And you stop thinking about just playing golf. How do I stop thinking about that?
Yeah, it comes down to awareness of your thoughts. That's really the first part about it. I used to do something funny, in the beginning. I'd throw 20 tees in my right hand pocket, and if I had a thought which wasn't productive, you know, thinking about winning or thinking about, you know, trying to birdie a hole or thinking about making double or whatever it was, I'd take a tee out, put it into my other pocket, And the first time I did it, I got three holes in the pocket was empty. Right. So, you know, I was having all these really poor thoughts. So what it got me doing, though, is it got me aware of my thoughts. And awareness is the big thing. So if you can actually be aware of those thoughts and turn that to your advantage, that's really how it all starts. So from there, you know, if I'm walking down the fairway, what I tended to do after hitting a shot was try and switch off. For me, I use my glove after I hit a shot. I'd take my glove off, and that ripping sound of the Velcro, as the glove came off, was my cue to switch off. Basically, I didn't want to think about golf. I wanted to talk to my caddy or my playing partners, or I'd start looking at the birds and the trees and basically just think about anything but golf. And for the average golfer out there playing any club comp, that's kind of what you want to do, because if you start thinking about golf all the way down the fairway before you get to your next shot, by the time you get there, you're going to be just worn out completely. So being able to switch off in this game is a really underrated skill. So find something that works for you. For me, it was a glove. You know, I just kind of took my glove off and bang, I switched my mind off, started chatting to people, just anything but golf. And when I got to my ball, the glove came back on and then I was kind of locked in again. And that was the best way for me.
I remember Freddie Couples was once asked what he was thinking by TV. He was standing, I don't remember the tournament, or it was a big one though, like a PGA Tour tournament. He might have been leading by one or even he was in the middle of the fairway and he had this approach shot, you know, and he hit it stiff. And the TV guys asked him, "Freddie, you know, what were you thinking? You know, standing over that shot, that important shot." And Freddie answered in his Freddie way, "Nothing. Like, I wasn't thinking of anything." But I remember, you know, we had a beer once and I told you that yarn and you're a bit skeptical. You're not calling Freddie a liar, but you'd be able to provide a bit more context for the comment. Can a man think of nothing? Can you just empty your mind, or is it just totally, you're able to transfer? Because you can't stop thinking, can you? Or can you?
That's the trick in the game. I think with most people, when they play their best golf, they kind of come off the course and go, "Wow, that was pretty easy, relaxed, didn't really think about too much. You know, I felt pretty light out there and, that was pretty simple." But when you have a bad day or when you're struggling, you're like, your mind's going a million miles an hour. So, you know, I'm sure Freddie probably had a swing thought in his head or something like that, but he's a pretty relaxed, easygoing guy, as you can probably tell when you watch him playing. But for me, what I tried to do was, you know, when I walked into the shot, got over the ball and swung away, All my focus was on executing the shot that I'd envisioned in my mind. So I tried to keep thoughts out. It was more mental imagery and sort of seeing things rather than thinking about things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
When you're over the ball, you want to feel your swing. You want to feel the shot rather than think about it. So maybe that's what Freddie was talking about there when he said, "Oh, I'm thinking about nothing." So he was probably feeling something, but he probably wasn't thinking something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's nice. Mm. Well, look, the idea for the book Tour Mentality came from playing with a couple of mates of yours at Isleworth. Decent players, you know, low handicappers. But so you're out there playing with these two amateurs, and some of the things that you told one of your friends, you know, resonated with him so much that he thought, you know, you should do a book, and you started to think that's a that's a good idea. So, mate, when you're, you know, mentoring, say, good young guys, the plus twos, the pennant players, you know, these young striplings that belt the ball a long way, do you pretty much tell those guys the same as you helped your sort of non-handicapper mate at Isleworth? Is there much more for a very good player as for a, you know, mug like the rest of us?
Oh, no, they're all similar principles, just at different levels. I mean, and that's the beauty of golf. You know, the pros are still all working on very similar things as the 15, 20 handicappers. It's just possibly at a different level, obviously. There's a little more fine-tuning going on, but the overall framework and the fundamentals are basically the same. You know, when I work with a player, it's just a case-by-case basis. And that particular day at Isleworth, I just could see this guy, you know, had a million swing thoughts going on in his head as he was trying to hit one of the hardest tee shots on the golf course. And I just backed him off and said, "Look, forget all that crap. I know that you're thinking about different things in your swing. I can see your rhythm's all out. Why don't we just focus on a target, see that, you know, tree in the distance, pick that out and just let the swing go and don't even worry about where it goes." And all of a sudden he started hitting the ball well. And he hit a great shot there and got to the ball after that, and he says, "Well, what do I do now?" And I said, "Well, do it again." And after a few holes of this, he's saying, is it really that simple? And I said, well, yes and no. I mean, you've basically simplified the game down to seeing a target, reacting to it and hitting it. And, you know, in a nutshell, that's kind of the game in a way. The biggest thing about golf and how it's different to most other sports is in golf, we hit a stationary ball. So we have to, you know, put all the momentum into it, where most other sports like footy, cricket, basketball, you name it, the ball's moving. So you can actually react. Yeah. It's more of a reactionary type thing. And in golf, that's really hard to do. So I help people with that, more reacting to shots rather than, you know, trying to move it themselves and things like that. But it's a case-by-case basis, and what I tend to do is play with them first up. I like to see how they go on the golf course first, see what they do and well and what they possibly don't do well. And, you know, we chat a lot about the mental game and also their individual styles and things like that. I'm a big believer in players playing to their personality. You know, if they're a jumpy, upbeat guy and they're trying to slow everything down on the course, that's probably not going to work for them. Whereas if they're a very methodical and sort of easygoing guy off the golf course, well, they should, you know, not be playing at a million miles an hour. They should take their time on the golf course as well. So it's a case-by-case basis in that sense.
You're big on pre-shot routine, as probably a lot of golfers are. You call it the PSR. And you're right, the PSR has got two components, D for decide and E for execute. You sort of say, well, you know, one is left side of brain, one is right side a little bit. D for decide is the thinking bit, the creative side. Give us your interpretation of that first, when you walk up to the ball and decide what you're going to do.
Yeah, I shorten everything, by the way, PSR, D, E, A, everything like that, because I got lazy because I was writing them all in my yardage book and I didn't have enough room to write everything, so I started writing all these acronyms. But, yeah, when you get to the ball on the golf course, whether it's a tee shot on the fairway, on the putting green, whatever, you basically have a decision to make, and it's important to make that decision before you step into the ball. You don't want to be thinking about that while you're over the ball. So I like to break up what I call the PSR, the pre-shot routine, into two phases, the decision phase and the execute phase. The decision phase is all about, okay, how far have I got? Where's the pin? Where's the wind coming from? What sort of shot do I want to hit here? What club is it? Et cetera, et cetera. And once you've made up your mind on whatever the right shot is for yourself, that's basically your decision. And the important part from then on is to commit to it and not doubt yourself. What tends to happen with most people is as they get over the ball, they're like, is it 7 or is it 6 iron? Oh, I'm not sure about this now. If that happens, back off and think, well, why am I thinking that, you know, and reevaluate. So if you're over the ball with any doubt in this game, you're going to really struggle. So I'd rather you commit to hitting the wrong club than being doubtful about the right one.
Nice. And the execute stage, Jack Nicklaus has a lovely quote or turn of phrase. He calls it going to the movies, which is visualizing the shot in your head and seeing, feeling your body, how it hits it, and then watching the ball flying through the air and stuff. I love that. I love the imagery of that, sort of mentally seeing it. Is that what you mean when you talk about execution?
Yeah, Jack was great with that. You know, I remember reading about that a while back. He would actually see the flight of the ball, the path it took the whole way there, landing on the green, rolling out.
Yeah.
I'm probably not as much in that detail.
Yeah.
But I do like to see a shape through the air. And, you know, where I want the ball to land and sort of finish. So, I mean, obviously in the hole every time would be nice, but sometimes we can't do that. But it's more a general thing for me. And the idea with that is once you move into that side of things, you're moving into the creative side and the feel part of your brain, which is the, I think it's the right side of your brain. The decision-making, all the logical stuff, that's on the left side. And once you get into that feeling, sensing, you know, visual, that sort of thing, you're in the right side. So, and in your creative side, and that's where the really fun stuff happens.
Yeah.
That's where artists, you know, create masterpieces. That's where great footballers have these skills that you're just seeing flow and everything. It's nothing's ever mechanical or technical. So some players tend to be more left side than others, but I always enjoy watching those more right side players like Seve and you know, Ben Crenshaw on the greens. He was just phenomenal. It was like it was just like watching an artist. That guy on the greens, he hardly ever bent down to read a putt. It was just an amazing thing to see. So I'm very much that way on a lot of my shots. It may not look that way. I used to be known as kind of Mr. Consistency and a bit of a robot on the golf course, but I can tell everyone I was very much feeling and being very creative with my shots.
Yeah, those sunglasses made you look like a bit of a Terminator.
Yeah, going on Terminator, there you go.
Be interesting to see inside Bubba Watson's head when he's thinking about cutting the ears off some dog leg 450 yards away.
Yeah, I think
the movie's going on in his melon.
Yeah, he's the most creative guy you'll ever see. I mean, he can't see a straight shot. The hardest shot for him is a straight one. He's always seeing massive left to right or right to left. So it's fun to watch.
Mate, as a young touring pro, and I suppose there's some advice for young blokes, you know, trainee pros who are thinking about a crack on tour and such, as probably all young golfers would. When you were a young bloke, you know, looking to earn cards, doing Q school and stuff like that, how did you cope with the pressure of that, of earning cards, earning a living, making money, a living? I think, you know, it was you and your young wife were on tour, so you're sort of supporting her too, if you like. Well, you know, she's supporting you, obviously, as your caddy and companion. But I think, you know what I mean, there's arguably bigger pressure. Well, I think there is bigger pressure when you're broke trying to earn a living than when you're a multimillionaire, you know, who's just playing for trophies. You know, Rory said something about it the other day. He doesn't care about the FedEx Millions. He's loaded, so he's sweet. But as a young bloke, you know, when you were coming into the game, how'd you cope with the pressure of playing golf but also making a living from it, or the pressure of that it's your career? And
yeah, I mean, when you start now, that is definitely the hardest part of your career, I think, because it's the unknown, and are you going to be good enough? Are you going to make it? And really the only person that knows is yourself. I mean, I was very, very lucky to have an understanding wife, my wife Alana. She, you know, we both worked night jobs, temp jobs, whatever we could, just to help support me to go and play in the early beginning. And then the big turnaround for us was just making a plan and committing to it and sticking to it and giving myself a time frame more than anything. I gave myself 3 years in the beginning to have some sort of success out of the game. And if I didn't, well, then I was going to do something else. So once I had that direction and that path, that sort of freed me up a little bit.
Okay.
If you're kind of meandering along and thinking that, you know, there's no real direction here, well, that's when guys struggle with it. And going to your point with Rory, I mean, yeah, he won, what, $15 to $20 million in the FedEx Cup the other day. As you say, it means nothing to him.
Put it with the rest.
Whereas what does mean is something to him is trying to win the British Open, you know, in his home country of Northern Ireland, and he can't keep it in bounds. So there's pressure for you there, and that had nothing to do with money. So, but for the young pros out there, I feel for them. You know, I've been there, done that, and it's getting tougher and tougher every year. So it really just comes down to your self-belief and really trying to get better every day. And if you do that for a number of years, then generally good things can happen.
Mate, you're probably best known in Australia, arguable, but, mate, you won the 2006 Australian PGA Championship with a storied playoff with the great Peter Lonard. You went into a playoff with him after missing a three-footer on the 72nd hole because you were thinking of winning, making a speech. and you're very honest with that in your book. Talk us through that, mate, and I suppose what that taught you and how you were able to reset and comport yourself actually to go into the playoff with Pete. And I think you played another four holes or so before holding a bunker shot, I believe. But talk us through it, mate, anyway.
Yeah, no, it was people asking me what's the best and worst moments of your career, and I said, well, it all happened within an hour.
Oh, yeah.
So, the worst moment was missing a three-foot putt to win the PGA Championship, and the best was holding that bunker shot an hour later on the fourth playoff hole. So it was a crazy day. I mean, it was at a time, 2006 was probably my best year on tour, and through the mid-2000s, I was playing some really good golf, and I was kind of known as a very consistent golfer that won very little. So I get, you know, every week I'd get asked, well, how are you going to win? Why haven't you won? Especially in the US, they'd go, you're top 30 in the world and you've never won here. How can you justify that? And I would say, well, actually, I find it a compliment because it means I must be pretty damn consistent. So that particular tournament was, it was kind of one of the peaks of my career where I played some amazing golf, shot 63 on the Saturday at Coolum in the PGA. If I could play Coolum every tournament, I would have been number one in the world. That golf course just suited me down to the ground.
Yeah.
And then Sunday, it was a bit of a head-to-head match with Pete. We were going back and forth the whole way, and he sort of jumped ahead early. I pegged him back, and coming down the last, I had a nice little one-shot lead and just had to two-putt from about 30 or 40 feet, left it 3 feet short. And Pete had a putt from about, I reckon, about 8 feet for par. And in a way, I was almost going, oh, I hope he misses it, you know, which is a worst thing you can possibly think of because you've still got to make it. And I quickly slapped myself out of that moment, which was fine. And then when he made it, I was sort of standing behind the ball and I was actually saying, oh, what am I going to say later on? You know, I'm going to hold the trophy. And I was like, oh, what are you doing? And I got over the ball realizing this and I should have backed away, never did, and missed it and thinking, you idiot. So, yeah, I should have asked myself that question. I always did, like, what do I have to do right now? But I never did, unfortunately. Yeah. So we're all human. And what got me out of it was my caddy, Wilbur. He was with me my whole career. And as we're in the scorer's hut, I was dropping a couple of F-bombs here and there. And apologies to the scorers that were in there at the time. And he just gave me a good talking to. He says, mate, you're playing great. Pull your head out of your ass. Let's go kick some butt in the playoff. You know, you haven't lost it. We're still in it. And four holes later, I was holding the trophy. So it was a pretty cool day. And the village square, we certainly drank the wine. It was flowing that night, put it that way. So it was a good night.
So how were you able to, on every one of those playoff holes, were you just sort of treating it as, yeah, it's obviously head-to-head, it's you versus him, but again, what did you have to do? Was it shot, putt, putt sort of thing? Or is that?
Yeah, I mean, we just kept playing the 18th at Coolum, which is a long par four around water, and I was flushing it. So the water never even entered my mind from the tee or the second shot. It was just a matter of, okay, can I make a putt? And I think on the second playoff hole, I thought I'd made it. I had like a 15, 20 footer and I thought, oh, that's in halfway there and it missed. And then Pete had a chance as well. And I was just playing really good golf and I'd forgotten about the 72nd hole by then, funnily enough. You know, it was just a massive crowd. It was a great spectacle out there. And every shot I felt, well, this is the one. I'm going to make it. And when I got in that bunker, I just had a good feeling. I'd been there before and I never thought it was too difficult a bunker shot, even though there's water behind as you're looking at it.
And, well, that would make most amateurs shit. So.
Yeah, no, I know, but that's one of my strengths is bunker play. Yeah, so
you're good.
as soon as I hit it, it felt good, and it was just a matter of, well, if it goes in, it's my day. If it doesn't, it's not. And fortunately it did. So, yeah, once I got into the playoff, I really had forgotten about everything else because if, you know, I had two choices. I was either just going to completely lose it and hit some bad shots after thinking about a 3-foot putt, or I could just crack on with it, and that's what we did. So it was a great day.
Well done. Mate, a feature going forward of the podcast will be us talking about current events, you know, PGA Tour events, the Aussie Open, Vic PGA is coming up, and we'll talk about, you know, players who did well or even did poorly. The President's Cup's coming up, and your thoughts on how top players kept themselves composed or didn't coming down the stretch. And you mentioned Rory, and we'll talk about him in a second. But last year, and you'll remember it, I'm sure, Gary Woodland became the US Open champion. He hit a beautiful 3-wood on a par 5 that had to go over, you know, death, which was a beautiful shot. But you can sort of see that in him, given the style of player he is. But he hit a shot on a par 3. It was either 16 or 17. I'm pretty sure it was 17. It was a lob wedge off the green. And he made a par and he got up and down. But, you know, a lob wedge off a green, again, you know, for amateurs, that's an extremely scary shot to keep your hands soft and just to execute. And Gary Woodland, who'd never won a major, pulled that shot off under that pump and Brooks Koepka was coming at him. How did he do that? I mean, you would have watched it. Looking at his body language and all that, how did Gary Woodland do that?
Well, I think if you watched his body language all day, he just looked really composed. So, and he has that. A bit of aura about him as well. He's very similar to Dustin Johnson in that sense. You know, they kind of walk around with a bit of a swagger and pretty cool, calm and collected. So now what's going on underneath that? I mean, who knows? But he, for me, watching that last day, it just looked like he was in real control of his game. Whenever he did make a bogey or hit a bad shot, he pegged it back straight away and seemed to right the ship. And, you know, I know exactly the shot you're talking about. It's a 17th hole.
Yep.
It's kind of an hourglass shaped green. The pin was on the left and he was on the right. And the only option to get it close was to chip it.
Yeah.
I think he had a 2-shot lead at the time. And the one thing that they said he'd really been working hard on was his chipping with Pete Cowan. Pete, he's an English coach who coaches many of the great players over the years, Henrik Stenson and all those boys. And he's a phenomenal short game coach. And, And I heard he'd been working with him, and to take that shot on at that moment, I mean, that's
yes.
that was impressive. I was watching, I'm thinking, well, yeah, he could sort of chip it to the side and he might have a 15-footer or putt it to the side. He may make it, he may not. He'll still have a one-shot lead going up the last. And when he took it on and hit the shot, I mean, he nipped it perfectly. It spun and it was like a foot or two away. So having a two-shot lead playing the 18th at Pebble, maybe that's what he was thinking about, because with a one-shot lead at Pebble playing the 18th, that's anything can happen because of the C next to it. Whereas a two-shot lead, well, that changes the whole strategy altogether. So all credit to the guy for doing that. Took balls of steel to do it. And obviously he trusted his short game that had been working on really hard with Pete Cowan. So I took my hat off to him on that one.
Yeah, so pretty much just preparation, prep, that he had the confidence and trusted his game and trusted his hands and, you know, knew he had the shot, but still, bloody.
Yeah. Well, he had that composure all day. I mean, he was looking a bit edgy, you know, throughout the day.
That was edgy for him.
It set the scene for him, really. Just the way he was walking around and his presence that day was phenomenal. And I think he just backed himself. As I said, if he was a bit up and down and struggling, well, yeah, maybe he might have putted it, taken his four, and then tried to just squeak it into the clubhouse. But he thought, no, you know what? I'm ready. This is me. I can do it. And this is why we're here. So, yeah, all credit.
There he goes. Well, conversely, the great Rory McIlroy, who, you know, he's walked off with 15 mil, but not his home championship after an 8 on the first at Port Rush. Actually, I went on a golf tour there, just came back from one about 3 weeks, a month ago. And of our 12 strong party, all we had to do was beat 8. That was the target. So sorry, Rules. We all did. Watching Rory in that, you know, because obviously he was a big focus of so much media attention. Did you see him knock out that 8? And did you looking at him through your tour mentality glasses? Did you see him struggling, or would you have had any advice for him before the hole? I mean, it's hard to give Rory McIlroy advice, but
hindsight's a very easy thing, obviously.
Yeah. But,
you know, I think one thing with Rory is he's almost a bit of a flat-out player all the time. It can be hard for him to dial it back, and perhaps the nerves, the energy that was running through his body at that time just possibly, you know, rather than taking a 2-iron off the tee, hit a 3-4-5-iron just to get the ball in play and get himself away. Obviously, that's easier said than done after the fact.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I thought he was a little unlucky with that tee shot. I mean, he pulled it, and it looked like it wasn't too bad a swing. And I haven't played the course, so I don't know how wide it is from the left out of bounds to the right. But it doesn't look that generous. And I think there might have been a bit of wind blowing that day. So he missed out of bounds by a yard. After that is where it kind of snowballed for him. I think he was thinking, oh, well, I've hit 3, now I'm in the rough. I've got to make bogey or double at worst, and he sort of compounded the fact by missing the green on the wrong spot and things like that. So rather than taking his medicine and just say, okay, let's make 6-7 at the worst, let's get out of here, and unfortunately he just kind of snowballed away. So it was a tough one to watch, that's for sure, but all credit to him for the next day. I mean, he just played some phenomenal golf that Friday to try and make the cut, and to miss by one, it was a real shame. But it was fortunate that an Irish guy won in the end anyway, so
yeah, well,
I felt a bit sorry for him in that case, but not too sorry after he won the 15 mil.
Yes.
Shane Lowry.
Well,
yeah, and he's got the game to win around a golf course like that. You can just tell he's got that feel and that touch to play a windy links. And that's what British Opens are all about. You know, you need that creativity.
Yeah.
You know, someone like a Bryson DeChambeau, probably not going to win a British Open because he's, you know, obviously a numbers guy, and numbers guys generally don't win the Opens.
Yeah, well, Shane's, you know, his body language just, again, look very confident. You can sort of look in a man's eyes, if you like, and see how they're going. And he just, you know, just seemed to be wandering around almost enjoying himself, what he was, obviously.
Yeah, he didn't seem to have high expectations of himself. I think going into the week, he was struggling with his game.
Yeah, okay.
He sat down with his coach and they just sort of said, you know, well, what have you got to lose? Just go out there and play and see what happens. And I think Saturday was probably the greatest day of his life he's ever played on a golf course. I mean, it was a phenomenal round. So, and having that home support and that crowd was incredible. And there was a massive turning point on that Sunday morning, Sunday, the final round on the first hole when he was playing with Fleetwood. I think Fleetwood had a 10-footer for birdie.
Yeah, that's right.
And Lowry had a 10-footer for bogey, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
So it could have been a three-shot swing.
That's right.
Yep. It was only a one-shot swing. So
yes.
That basically set the scene for the day. So all credit to him.
Playing in wind, as people can do, I play in a bit of wind. It helps to sort of lower your expectations, and it's obviously helped Shane Lowry to win the Open Championship, because if he'd been going like a sort of a busted going into it. But is that something you advise players on tougher days? Is that a good thing to lower expectations, or should you just go and play golf?
No, you're just trying to play golf. And
okay,
if you play the best you can, some days, you know, for a pro, some days a 72 is a really good golf score.
Yeah.
On a horrible day, and other days the 72 is a horrible score if it's perfect and the conditions are there for the taking. So all you're trying to do is play to the best of your ability, and the course and the conditions will dictate what you score. Now, obviously there's a lot of practice and everything that goes into those sorts of days. So that's the beauty of moving back to Melbourne, actually. You know, through the winter, I've loved getting out there in the rain and the wind and the cold and playing, and don't really experience that in Florida. So it's been fun sort of playing in those conditions again. So I might make a run at a British Open again later on. You never know.
well, tell us first. We'll get the scoop.
Yeah, exactly.
In future episodes of the podcast, we'll talk about practice and structured practice and having fun with practice. And because, it's obviously, again, it's not something that a lot of amateurs don't do enough of, probably because, you know, you go out and beat balls and it's sort of, sort of a bit soulless and boring, really. But, anyone who gets good at golf enjoys their practice. And I'm sure you'd have some tips for making it fun and doing it so that it's effective and such. And we'll get to that down the track. All right, but that's us for the moment, Nico. We'll close off episode one of Tour Mentality, the podcast, with the great Nico Hearn. Look, folks, we'll be knocking these out roughly weekly or fortnightly. We'll see how we go. Maybe, I think more often when golf's big in the news, maybe once a day around the Australian Open. I know Nick's playing in the Victorian PGA coming up, and if we can sneak in one or more during the day, we will. Just a thought. See how we go. And listeners, if you'd get a copy of Nick's book, check out nickohearn.com. If you get on one of his clinics or go on tour with him, or if you'd like to ask him a question, email me, matt@mattcleary.com. That's matt@mattcleary.com, or contact Nick via his website. Tell him you heard him on the podcast and would be keen to ask him something, or get on one of his clinics on tours. Geez, I'm rambling like a fool. But that's us, Nick. Thanks, mate. Have a good week. What's on for your week? What's on for your weekend, mate? You're playing Royal Melbourne or Kingston Heath or something, hey?
I wish. A pretty quiet one, actually. Day off tomorrow just with the family, which will be fun. School holidays are starting. And then Sunday, I'm actually working with a young fella who, believe it or not, is a promising cricketer, but helping him with his golf, which will then help translate into his cricket and things like that. So I'm getting into other sports now, which is great, because I think they all cross over with very similar things that you can learn from every sport, and then also some corporate stuff as well. So I'm looking forward to Sunday. Get out to a place actually called Burnley Golf Course, a little 9-hole public course, bit of fun. So
nine holes. Yeah, I've just been talking to Mike Clayton and a few other guys about the efficacy of 9-hole golf, and while we don't have a few more, he said Frankston was a nice one down that way too, a nice 9-holer. But why we aren't building more of them given time constraints in our modern times. But anyway, mate, look, things we can talk about in the future. Thanks again, mate. Have a good week. And thanks, all the listeners. Go well. Enjoy your golf. And that's us, Tour Mentality, episode one. Bye for now.